south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Okay, let's start out once again with a little Latin American sociology, and in this case, it's tied to banking. Now, the good news for all gringos and expats is that if you come down here and open a bank account, these days in any bank that's got any kind of branches whatsoever, they'll let you open a dollar account. Though I might add these days, it won't be you personally opening that account. It'll be you and your lawyer, or just your lawyer opening it for you. Since, as you probably know by now, and I've mentioned it before, banks in any foreign country don't want American citizens as clients anymore because they have to deal with all that paperwork involved in those rotten FATCA laws and report your account details and movements back to the IRS in the States. But anyway, let's say you're a brand new expat in Honduras, and you and your lawyer go down to the local bank and open up a U.S. dollar account. You know, this is Latin America, so it could take a couple of hours, but it'll happen. You'll actually get it done. Now, that's a lot different than it was 5 or 10 years ago, when only the 3, 4, or 5 largest banks in any Latin American country would offer dollar accounts. But that's all changed in the last 3 or 4 years. That means when you come down, you can open a bank account in the local currency, pesos, bolivars, doubloons, whatever, and at the same time, get yourself a dollar account, 2 birds with 1 stone. And about euro accounts, well, they're about in the same position the dollar accounts were 5 or 10 years ago, meaning only the 3, 4, or 5 largest banks in any Latin country offer euro accounts. Why? Because basically the euro just hasn't taken off down here that much. So unfortunately, a lot of Europeans are stuck changing their euros into dollars and losing twice on the conversion to the local currency. Now, it doesn't cost you anymore to have a U.S. dollar account here, except that generally you must deposit a much higher amount to open that account than you would with a local currency account. For example, if you're in Honduras and you open a local currency account in lempiras, that's what they're called, you can actually open a Passbook Lempira account with an initial deposit of 100 lempiras, $6. As opposed to opening a U.S. dollar passbook account, which would normally require an initial deposit of about $100. Big deal, you say, right? For us, no, but for regular Hondureños, yes, because $100 is like a week to a week and a half's salary for them. And relating that to the average first world American, imagine opening a regular passbook savings account and having to deposit $600 to $1,000. No small thing, right? Anyway, when you're down here opening a U.S. dollar account, you'll need to deposit $100. And of course, you don't lose that money. It's just your opening balance. Oh, and by the way, I'll admit that Honduras has a very weird-sounding currency, the lempira. So how do gringos manage to remember such a strange name for a currency? Well, I'll tell you how some of us do it. Just imagine a slimy, disgusting lamprey eel, because the word lamprey sounds and looks a lot like lempira. Anyway, there's a little memory trigger for you. And by the way, when you're learning your Spanish, it's a great idea to use as many of those language triggers as possible. That is, connect the Spanish word you're trying to imagine to some oddball person, place, or thing in English. And in fact, that's how some of these memory whizzes remember long strings of numbers, by connecting each number to some odd or outrageous physical or mental picture. Try it. It really works. But you knew that already, right? So when you open a U.S. dollar bank account down here, the fact is you won't have very much company. In fact, the statistics coming out of the financial pages of the big Latin American newspapers state that right now, only about 1 out of 80 bank accounts is linked to a dollar bank account. And if you exclude businesses, and about 1 in 5 of those have dollar bank accounts, that means when you're strictly talking about individuals, that means only about 1 in 200 Latin American people who have some kind of bank account have a dollar-denominated account too. And those stats are for all of Latin America. Now, if you're on the high-volume gringo tourist trail, then you'll find the majority of people who have bank accounts have dollar accounts too, because many of them are getting paid or tipped in dollars. And by the way, like I've mentioned in past shows, I think, every single Latin you talk to thinks the U.S. dollar is the gold standard. They have absolutely no idea that since the birth of the Federal Reserve in 1913, a dollar today is worth about 4 cents. Or is it 3? But then again, 95% of U.S. citizens don't know their dollar has shrunk in value to the size of a postage stamp either. So if you get a chance to quiz a Latin American who happens to have a U.S. dollar bank account as to why he would maintain such a thing, even though more than likely it's been inactive since the day he opened it, they'll often say it's because their own currency is so undependable. But they're stuck with it. And every last one of them remembers the good old days when they were kids, when one single peso or balboa or lempira or quetzal bought them a nice lunch at a fancy restaurant. Whereas today, for example, one lempira is worth one U.S. nickel. And what, if anything, can you buy with that? So the vibe you pick up from every Latin person, in fact, the vibe you pick up from every adult person over 35, is that they really have no faith in their central bank, their politicians, and the people who run their monetary system. And Latin businessmen who've been around the block for a while will tell you how their currency's been whipsawed and devalued, how bank and CD interest rates in their local currency almost never beat inflation, even though CD and government bond interest rates can sometimes be 3 and 4 times what you could get with dollar-based CDs. Now, when you run into a Latin who can explain all that, what he's really doing is comparing the history of his currency to the U.S. dollar, because that's their gold standard of measure. In fact, I can't tell you how many times I've been at some wealthier Latin guy's house, and if and when the subject turns to banking, finance, or the economy, and I've heard the guy or his friends say, God, I wish I would have had my money in U.S. dollars instead of pesos or lempiras or doubloons or quetzales. Oh yeah, and that reminds me, let's talk about quetzales for a minute, which, whether you know it or not, is the national currency of Guatemala. That's quetzales, not quetzals or quetzales or even quensals or quensales, as fresh green gringos and expats often mispronounce it. Even though there's no N in the word, gringos like to slip one in. And that's why in Guatemala, when gringos gather, you'll often hear them use the term Q. That's it. Basically to avoid mispronouncing the word quetzales and getting weird looks from the natives. That means 10 quetzales becomes 10 Q. Easy, huh? But unfortunately, that only seems to be an understanding between gringos. They can talk tens and twenties and hundreds and thousands of Qs to themselves all day long, but the locals don't get that, so you'll eventually have to make a stab at saying the word quetzal, which is singular for one quetzal, or the plural, quetzales. And by the way, that's one way to find out if a gringo or an expat has actually spent a little time in Guatemala. If he's still saying quetzales or quensales, he probably hasn't been in and around the country for much time at all. And if he's prone to saying Qs all the time, then you know he's not far off the tourist track and has been hanging around with gringos. Which begs the question, is there a gringo tourist trail in Guatemala? Or in Honduras or Nicaragua? Or any of the Latin countries on the U.S. State Department feces list? Well, yes, there is a kind of a tourist trail in Guatemala, though nothing like Cancun, Panama, or Costa Rica. In fact, the only place that can kind of be qualified as a gringo tourist trail is the city of Antigua, Guatemala, which is famous for its Spanish ruins, great climate, and 25 or so cheap Spanish immersion schools, which draws a lot of North American and European backpacker types and low to medium budget eco-tourists. So yes, in Antigua you see gringos all the time, but it's not high-volume touristy as we've come to know that term. Even the massive Mayan ruins in Petén, the city of Tikal, considered the Emerald City of the Mayans, it's massive, spectacular, astounding, and all the best adjectives, and goes on for miles and miles. Yet still, it gets nowhere near the traffic of those big Mayan ruins in Mexico, like Chichen Itza. In fact, I remember a tour guide at the Tikal ruins once told me they're lucky to get 5% of the tourist spillover that Chichen Itza gets. Maybe it's because it's just so far away from everything, way out in the jungle, with no big city, not even a lightly populated one, within an hour's drive. And the way I look at it, it's a good thing. In fact, it's great. It's one place you can get completely overwhelmed by without any idiot kid with a camera or an iPhone sticking his elbow in your eye. Now, of course, the Guatemalan tourist bureaus and stuff promote the hell out of it, but it's really not had too much effect. The fact is, the U.S. State Department's website has really clipped the wings of the tourist business in Latin America, so in a backhanded way, for adventurous gringos and expats, the U.S. State Department makes these attractions much nicer places for us more adventurous gringos to visit. But what about the gringo tourist trail in Honduras? Is there one there? Well, yes, and that's the island of Roatan, though it's pretty low-key, too. But note that on the Honduran mainland, there really isn't a gringo tourist trail. In fact, there's another tremendous Mayan ruin, in fact, a huge city, in Copan, Honduras. And again, there's only a small trickle of gringo tourists going in the place. And it's really hard to believe considering the immensity of it. But that's why it's one of those hidden gems that your average gringo tourist rarely gets to see. The same with Belize and El Salvador and Nicaragua. They've got a tiny handful of places where you often see gringos. But again, there's no such thing as a real bona fide gringo tourist trail. But I digress. I was talking about that funny Guatemalan currency, the quetzal, that fresh new gringos and expats have such a hard time pronouncing. The confusing part for gringos being that it starts with a Q and has a Z in it, instead of a more convenient K and an S. And alas, us gringos like to pronounce our words phonetically, so we always screw up when we get to Latin America, especially with the indigenous names, where there's lots and lots of X's, Y's, and Z's and Q's. And in English, those letters are the least used. Even us very long-term expats blow words like that all the time, which, by the way, amuses the locals to no end, so get used to it. Okay then, what about that Quetzal name anyway? Where did it come from? Well, it's the name of a rare and spectacular bird whose long multicolored feathers were highly prized by Mayan royalty, which certainly helped to make them nearly extinct. Even today, they're so endangered that the average Guatemalan has never actually seen a live one, not even in a zoo, though he does see it every day on his country's flag and all his money, and on all the government propaganda, and on 101 products and advertisements. The Quetzal, it seems, is everybody's favorite bird and its public property, even though the public's killed off just about every last one of them. And get this. Once in a great while, you'll go to a wealthy Latin American's house. I'm talking about old money in a grand Spanish villa, built before the turn of the century, the last century. And lo and behold, you just might see among the other trophies in the owner's game room, a stuffed Quetzal. Of course, I'm talking a real dead one here. Admittedly, stalked and killed off a long time ago, maybe 100 years ago. Now, to me, that's really sad, killing off your heritage and stuffing it like that. But some men have their game rooms and just have to show off their trophies. For Guatemalans, the Quetzal bird is what the bald eagle is to North Americans. And isn't it ironic that the bald eagle is not only extremely endangered too, but that the vast majority of Americans have never actually seen a live one either? And I'll bet you a Bitcoin, if an American kid with a BB gun happened to see one, he'd take a pot shot at it. Because boys will be boys, and not only that, North American kids can afford BB guns, whereas Latin kids can only afford slingshots. Oh, and by the way, half the Latin kids actually make their own slingshots from scratch. Now, it's not that the Quetzal bird species has been completely eliminated. Now, there are some known nesting pairs in the jungle wilds, and bird watchers from all over the world come down and spend a big buck to take a long, long trek through the jungle with a guide, hoping to get a photo op. Of the male, that is, because he's the one with the nice feathers. The fact is, if you talk to any real old-time Guatemalans, guys in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, if they were born and raised in the boonies, they'll often have a story of a friend or acquaintance of theirs when they were boys, who'd tapped one of these rare birds with his slingshot. Because you see, nearly all young Latin American boys, especially ones in the boonies, have very powerful slingshots. And unfortunately, boys being boys, their main goal is to plug anything that moves. And those poor, beautiful Quetzales birds, with their 2 and 3 foot long multicolored tails, well, that was the grand prize. And I've been told, second only to the Quetzal is the macaw parrot. And down here in Latin America, they're called guacamayas, which, by the way, is also a nearly impossible word to say phonetically. And suffice to say, it takes a gringo an awful long time to master that one. Anyway, guacamayas, or macaw parrots, are beautiful and spectacular birds too, and I've been told, easily picked off with a nice slingshot. Though, thankfully, those guys breed fast and in very high trees. Though they're technically endangered, you still see them, often as pets, in restaurants, bars, and resorts. And, believe it or not, if you get far enough out in the jungle, in the wild. Oh, and one more thing about guacamayas. A lot of gringos and expats, when they first come down here, they think of getting one or two of those things as a pet, since occasionally, when you're out in the boonies, you run into a guy or a gal selling one or two on the street. And of course, absolutely dirt cheap compared to first world prices. Wait a minute, what am I saying? I don't think you can even buy one of those things up north. They are endangered, right? Anyway, I've personally seen these things for sale on the street. And of course, that's not legal, but since there are no bird or endangered animal police down here, and if there are, that's news to me. Now, of course, you could never ship these things out of the country, since at the borders, or as they're called, frontiers down here, the border cops and contraband police are really checking for things like that. Though I know that kind of trafficking does go on because gringos up north pay big prices for those things. Anyway, what I'm saying is, within Latin American countries, even though these big, beautiful birds, the guacamayas, the macaws, are endangered, you see an awful lot of them around as pets. Like I said, in hotels, restaurants, bars, and occasionally at a person's house. So how does that happen if they're endangered? Well, you tell me. This is Latin America, you know. So anyway, the occasional gringo or expat down here, when he sees these things are available as pets, sometimes he or she gets the idea he's got to have one too. Now, these things do need a lot of space, and what I've been told is that you have to clip their wings and give them a nice big space to roam in the house. A big tree stand area they can perch in. Or even better, a nice big caged-in leafy area out in the garden. But I'll warn you right now, based on a few gringo friends that have those things, it's not a good idea to keep those big birds in captivity or as pets at all. And you know, those minimum requirements I just mentioned, big open space, maybe a huge area in the backyard, you just don't see those kind of accommodations when Latins own those birds. Though I admit, in some of the big hotels that have them, it can be a very nice setup. But that's the exception, not the rule. So for all you bird lovers out there, I can think of three or four very good reasons not to have them. So listen up. First of all, those things are big and wild, and it's kind of cruel to keep them all cooped up. Secondly, even though they're very intelligent and have a great vocabulary when you get them talking, they somehow just can't be house trained, which means you can never have nice furniture, carpets, or throw rugs around, meaning if you have nice stuff, it won't be for long. And the third reason not to have one of these things, they have a hideously loud, annoying squawk, and they squawk at the most inopportune times. Not to mention, if you've got a pair of them, look out, because when one starts up, the other one always chimes in. And since they're big birds, their squawk is so loud, if you're a peace and quiet loving person, they'll just drive you to the nut house. So anyway, if you're coming down to Latin America and you have an eye on a bird like that as a pet, or any big tropical bird or endangered species for that matter, if you really are a bird lover, you'll let them live where they want to live, in the jungles and in the trees. Oh, and another thing, those birds are big and powerful and can really bite. They can take your finger off. And you know kids, they like to touch, prod, and poke colorful things. Enough said about that. So anyway, like I said before, that Quetzal bird that's on all Guatemalan money, that famous bird that practically no one's ever seen live. Now the fact is that there's only a couple of known surviving pairs has prompted some European genetic engineers and cloning specialists to come down to collect cells and preserve them to take a shot at future cloning. Now that's the good news, but it's also kind of sad, isn't it? And like my buddy expat Eddie always says, no one would be worrying about things like that if that amazing-looking Quetzal bird was just a little bit uglier. Now, I said before that the Honduran money, the lempira, is also a difficult term to remember for gringos. Now, the really interesting thing about that name, the lempira, is that it's the only Latin American monetary denomination that's named after an indigenous tribal warrior, a guy whose tribe actually fought and died fighting off the Spanish invaders, which makes the name lempira unlike any other Latin American money. Just think how much that contrasts with the name of the Costa Rican money, Colón, which is the Spanish word for Columbus. And though these days up in the States, Columbus's rep has hit the skids, down here you still see Columbus's name everywhere, Colón in Spanish, of course. And down here with that lag time effect, no one's taken to the streets when another public building or monument gets named after the old discoverer slash conqueror. Down here, his rep is still pretty much intact, even though in reality, he's the guy that opened the door to misery in a couple of continents. In fact, the people down here are just now seeing the cracks in his facade, and I expect in the next couple of years, a few of his statues and monuments will be defaced and eventually bite the dust. And speaking of perpetually famous conquistadores, there is the Latin American monetary unit called the Balboa. You know, the guy the history books say discovered the Pacific Ocean. Which does seem amusing since millions of indigenous people knew it was there all the time, huh? Anyway, the Balboa is, or I should say was, the Panamanian monetary unit. At least it was until they dollarized. But still, in Panama, the coin change consists of U.S. dimes, nickels, and quarters. But also, there are coins of the same size as the American coins floating around in Panama, with the Spanish conquistador Balboa's head stamped on them. So Panama never quite gave up the Balboa. And by the way, if you're in Panama, those things make good souvenirs, but if you bring them back to the States, you can't spend them, even though they trade one for one with U.S. coins in Panama. My advice, if you're at the Panamanian airport and you're stuck with a pocket full of that stuff, give it to some of the scruffy-looking kids that are always hanging out there. They need it more than you need another Dunkin' Donut. And yes, they have Dunkin' Donuts at the Panamanian airport. Okay, where was I? Oh yeah. Then, for example, there's the Bolivar used in Venezuela. named after Simon Bolivar, who wasn't exactly a conquistador, but a Spanish revolutionary. Now, another odd one is the Paraguayan Guarani, named after an indigenous tribe and their language. So why would they name their currency after a language or a tribe? Well, it turns out when the country decided to select a name for its currency back in 1945 to replace the peso, and by the way, they say government officials there thought there were just too many other governments with pesos in Latin America, all of them with a completely different valuation. So back then in 1945, nearly 100% of the rural population of Paraguay, mostly farmers out in the boonies, spoke the Guarani language. So that's how that new currency got its name. However, these days, only about 50% of the rural folks speak that language, and local sociologists think that in a few years, it'll be the Guarani currency that outlasts the tribe and the language. So anyway, as far as Latin American currencies, the majority of them stick to their version of the peso, or the name of some historical colonial Spanish guy or conquistador. Man, did I take a verbal detour there. What was I talking about at the beginning of the show? Oh yeah, I started by talking about U.S. bank accounts in Latin America. Continuing with that, you'll find when you're off the gringo tourist trail, almost no average Latin Americans have a dollar bank account. In fact, what one banker friend of mine told me, that guy I told you before who works at Citibank, he said that fully three-quarters of all the U.S. dollar bank accounts there don't have any movement at all month over month. Basically, they're stagnant and just accumulating little charges and fees all the time for sitting there dormant. So you might ask, what's the point of having a bank account if you don't use it? And the Citibank guy said, great expectations? Good answer, huh? Then he went on to say that the quarter of those bank accounts that do get some action are generally from people and families who get those U.S. dollar remesas from friends and family back up in the States. However, the vast majority of Latin American families that get remesas, when they receive the funds, usually through the local Western Union, they don't save that money. They just convert it to the local currency and spend it right away. And that's why the vast majority of Latins getting those remesas do not have U.S. dollar bank accounts. For the average guy, it's just not necessary. Which brings up another legitimate question. Why don't they open up a U.S. bank account and take the wire transfer directly from a bank up in the States from their friends and relatives sending the remesa? That way they can avoid those oppressive Western Union charges that can work out to 20 to 30% of the money sent, especially when small amounts are transferred, like from $50 to $200. The average remesa, by the way, being around $100. Sent generally on a monthly or quarterly basis. Well, as you might have remembered from a past show, a large percentage of Latins up in the States sending remesas are not there legally, so they can't open bank accounts. So they can't do a bank-to-bank wire transfer like that. And that's why money transferring services like Western Union have moved in to suck up all that business, making well over $5 billion last year in profits. Now, regarding remesas, here's something that's really puzzling, and I hope someday someone can answer this. At the end of every calendar year, which just passed, by the way, all the big Latin American newspapers publish statistics about remesas coming from the U.S. to their country. Now, how they get precise data on that, I don't know, because certainly money transferring agencies like Western Union aren't talking. That's proprietary information, for sure. And because, like I just mentioned, banks in Latin America are not on the receiving end of a lot of remesas, then where do they get such precise data? What I mean is, just last month in December, I've seen charts in Latin American newspapers that show the amount of remesas coming into a country like Nicaragua broken down by every state in the U.S. Union. How do they come up with that stuff? So that's puzzling, but here's something else. For the last 3 years, I've been more or less monitoring these remesa numbers that are published, and here's the amazing thing. Every year for the past 3 years, the money returning back to the Latin country has been up by 3, 4, even 5% year over year. So I wonder, how can that be when we all know that U.S. and first world economies in general are in a tailspin and the real, not government-published, unemployment numbers in the States are around 20%? Those are Depression-era numbers. So considering all that bad news up north, and it's getting worse, how can there be more remesas year over year coming back to the people in Latin America from friends and relatives up in the States? You'd think those numbers would be way, way down. Especially since in the last year or two, I've seen articles in the local Latin papers that say many more illegals are returning back to their home Latin countries because they're disillusioned. And I don't mean they've been caught and deported back, though tens of thousands are deported every year. I'm talking about a different set of people in the States. Illegals that come back voluntarily. Now that's a new phenomenon, huh? And once back in Latin America, when they're interviewed, They all tell the same story. They can't find halfway decent jobs up in the States enough to support themselves. And in fact, the American dream they were looking for was exaggerated, if not for them, an outright lie. So what's up with that? And the fact that remises are on the increase. It would appear, looking at the statistics, that either more Latins living up in the States are getting better jobs and making more money, therefore can send more back home, or there are more Latins in the States, previously unemployed Latins, who are getting hired. Either way, I don't get it. Something is definitely screwy. Now, changing gears a second, most of you know that I like to tell you little idiosyncrasies about the Spanish language that you'll never learn from your Spanish teacher. Not up in the States or down here. After a while, there are certain words and phrases you pick up and use yourself, not realizing how odd or strange or sometimes funny they really are after just a little bit of analysis. For example, take the word friend. In Spanish, that's amigo, right? Simple. Now, take the word enemy. Well, get this. The word enemy in Spanish is en amigo. En amigo. The preface en with the word amigo after it, as if you're saying your enemy is your anti-friend. Which makes sense, all right, but why wouldn't they have a completely different independent word for it? Who knows? And though the words amigo and enemigo are very commonly used down here, it takes an English speaker who knows Spanish to pick up on the fact that part of that word enemigo means friend. It's like this. Imagine an American soldier in World War II calling Hitler his anti-friend. And if you think that's strange, here's another one. The word discapacitado means handicapped. But what it actually means precisely is incapable. Now, down here in Latin America, that word is slowly replacing the more politically incorrect term minus válido, which precisely means, in English, less than valid. The preface minus means minus or less, and the rest of the word válido means valid. Minus válido, less valid. So nowadays, when you go into a parking lot in a big shopping center or wherever, you'll notice those typical handicapped parking spots, many of which used to have a little sign above them or painted on the ground. The word minus válidos are slowly but surely being changed over to the more politically correct discapacitados. And in some Latin countries, they don't use discapacitado, they use incapacitado. Either way, that's the politically correct term these days. So you might wonder, is the public catching on to that? In a word, no, since there's about a 20-year lag time on that PC stuff.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture.